Tape recorded message number TL370. Otis Q. Sellers, Bible Teacher. I greet you in the faith and fellowship of our great God and Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, whose we are, whom we love, and whom we serve. In the study that I bring you today, I want to do my very best to answer a question. A question that comes to me regularly. What about all these versions of the Bible? What about all of these new versions that are constantly coming on the bookstands? Which version is the best version? What version do you use, and so on? Well, let me begin by saying that I believe that God has spoken. And I also believe that the record of what he has said is contained in the 66 books that we call the Old Testament and that we call the New Testament. That these 66 books are God's revelation to us. I do not believe that there is any revelation of God in the pyramids. I do not even believe that there is any inspired revelation of God in any other ancient writings. I believe that we are shut up, and I am shut up, to the 66 books from Genesis to the book of Revelation that make up what we call the Bible. I have read the so-called apocryphal books, but one who reads them and reads them with a knowledge of the New and the Old Testament, he will get the feeling very quickly that these are not a part of the inspired Word of God. That is my conviction. Now, I've been a student and a reader, and I've been a ransacker and a handler of this Bible for almost 60 years. And I believe it gives me the right to speak, to say something about it. And again, I say to you that this book gives every evidence of being a book that no man would write if he could. He wouldn't write a book like this. And that no man could write even if he would, if he wanted to. The words of Dr. I.M. Haldeman that I learned very early in my ministry. Well, last night I bought another version of the Bible. It cost me $18. That's quite a bit of money, but in these days of inflation, that's what most well-bound books cost. This version is called the New International Version. I bought it only last night, and I haven't even had time to examine it or look at it, but it is one more version which will be put on my shelves. It is one more version that will be consulted. From what I understand, and I've not yet gone into it, but from what I understand, that this New International Version is a completely new translation of the Holy Bible, made by over 100 scholars, working directly from the best available Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek text. That had its beginning in 1965 when, after several years of exploratory study by committees from the Christian Reformed Church and the National Association of Evangelicals, that a group of scholars met in Illinois and concurred in the need for a new translation of the Bible in contemporary English. That would be the English that we use today. And it declares that this group, though not made up of official church representatives, was trans-denominational, meaning that it cut across all denominations. It was trans-denominational. And its conclusions was endorsed by a large number of leaders from many denominations who met in Chicago in 1966. And it goes on to tell us that these participants, these distinguished scholars, United States, Great Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, that they worked together to give the project its international scope, that they were for many denominations, including the Anglican, the Assemblies of God, the Baptist, the Brethren, the Christian Reform, the Church of Christ, the Evangelical Free Church, the Lutheran, the Mennonite, the Methodist, the Nazarene, the Presbyterian, the Wesleyan, other churches, that they helped to safeguard the translation from sectarian bias. Well, now, I like that. And yet, as I read it, I have the feeling, I wonder if these men would have dared to have translated in such a way that something would have flatly contradicted, we will say, some favorite and long-held teaching of the Christian Reformed Church or of the Mennonite Church or of the Presbyterian Church? Or would they have tried to be ecumenical and find a teaching which would just not flatly contradict this? Just what would it be? So as I read it, I will know that this prejudice simply had to be there. Now, it seems strange, but we have to remind people all the time that the Bible was originally written in the Hebrew language and that we do not have the original manuscripts. They're just simply not to be found or have not been found up to this present time. And that the New Testament was written in Greek, not the classical Greek of the year AD 100, but the Koine Greek, which would mean the Greek that was in use by the common people. And that in order for you and for me to be able to read these, we need translations, we need versions. And a version is simply a version. That seems like a repetition, and I know that there is a law of language that says that you should never use the same word in defining a word. But let us say that there has been an accident, and you saw it, and I saw it. You were there, and I was there, and you give your version of it, and I give my version. And these versions will not agree in every detail. You saw it from one angle, and I saw it from another angle. And it could even be that I was prejudiced. And I have used this illustration, and I will repeat it at the risk of going over it maybe too many times, but let us say that there was an accident at a busy corner, and that this was witnessed by three or four men. The man who was nearest to it was standing right on the corner when the accident happened. Another man had his back to it, but he was walking down the street about 100 feet away, but he heard the squeal of the brakes, the tires, and he turned around and he actually saw it, but he saw it from 100 feet away. And then let's say that there was a third man who was watching this from a building. Or we'll say he was up here on the fourth floor and he was actually watching the flow of traffic and was even considering how many people skimmed the red light or came out before the green light was on. He was just watching this. And all at once, he saw the accident happen. Now, the man who was there saw it right close up that was standing on the corner. He was greatly frightened through the accident as the car spun around, and he was almost frightened out of his wits. He had to jump off back from the curb to get out of the road of it, and it just missed him by inches. He's upset, he's emotional, he's angry, he's mad because they endangered his life, and this is going to greatly influence his testimony as to which man ran the red light and who caused the accident, because he's just so upset that he can't tell about it. Now, the second man cannot say that he saw it because he turned around when he heard the noise and So the accident was over, and he just didn't happen to look at the lights, and so he cannot say who was responsible for this crash at this corner. But let's say that the third man, he was actually watching it. He was watching the lights go on and off. He had a clear view. He was in no danger. And he knows which car ran the red light and which man was at fault. So he runs out, gets the elevator. He comes down because he wants to, that fairness shall be achieved. And so he's going to be able to say that it was the green car, not the white one. It was the green car that ran the red light and ran into the white car that had the right-of-way. But when he gets down there, he discovers that the driver who was at fault is his neighbor and his friend, the man that helps him when he's got some work to do, the man that whose wife came over when his wife was sick. You can see how that this is going to influence his testimony. He's going to be careful of what he says because he wouldn't want to do a thing that would hurt his neighbor. Want to do just as much as he can help. So you can see how the version of these men, as they give their version of this accident that actually happened, how it is going to influence their testimony. It just can't help but influence. I actually will confess I'd want to help my good neighbor, who's been a help to me and friendly to me. If he were in an accident, he was at fault, I certainly wouldn't want to say anything that would make it look any worse, although I guess if I were put on the witness stand, I'd have to tell the truth, having taken an oath that I would do so. Now, let us remember that when men take the Greek text and they determine that they are going to make a translation of the New Testament, going to have to realize that there are certain prejudices going to come in here. These men have strong views. These men have their prejudices. These men have fixed ideas. And this is bound to influence their translation. It has been said that if any man knew the truth perfectly, and he knew all the truth, then he could give us in English exactly what the writer meant in the Greek, because what he would give us would be the truth. But there is no man that knows all the truth and knows the truth perfectly. Therefore, he could not give us a perfect version. And yet I believe that the best version will be based upon the truth that a man knows, and as we could say, that translations come out of knowing the truth, and truth also comes out of true translations, and the two of them work together. And yet the Bible was written in the Koine Greek. Now, modern Greek does not seem to be of any help in understanding ancient Greek. The reason for that is that the ancient Greek is now 2,000 years old. And one thing about language is that it's always making progress, because all languages, except the dead ones, are living things. And the Koine Greek of the Bible became a dead thing. That is, it has made no progress since it was used in the New Testament. Therefore, it is a fixed thing. Modern Greek is not able to understand this. Oh, he can read the characters better, and maybe he can find the pronunciation of it easier. But since it is not a spoken language, it is not studied like any other language. In other words, you would not study New Testament Greek in order to carry on a conversation. You would not do that. It's lacking in words. There is only about 5,200 words in its vocabulary, whereas I believe that there's 15,000 words in the classical Greek of that time. But God saw fit to limit this vocabulary to just about 5,200 words, which is the greatest possible help to us in understanding it. Now, but just remember that you begin with the Greek. Well, you say, now, what about these Greek manuscripts? What about this New Testament text that we work from? Well, When the when the King James Version was translated, it was translated in 1611, and they had to use as their source a text that was compiled from manuscripts which date largely to the 13th or the 15th centuries. But since 1611, a number of Greek manuscripts have been found dating back as early as the 3rd and the 4th centuries, with some of them even going back to the 2nd century. And while we do not have the original writings, which are often called the autographs, we do not have the original writings which came from the hands of the New Testament authors, yet all of these manuscripts taken together, these enable the textual scholars to discover a Greek text which is very close to, if not the original. Now, at the present time, it seems hard for me to comprehend this or understand it, but at the present time, there are certain men who are contending that the Textus Receptus, as we call it, are the so-called received text, that this is the real manuscript, and that this is the one that we should follow. And yet this does not take into consideration any manuscript at all that has been discovered since, shall we say, the year 1611, the year of the translation of the King James Version. Then there are others who are insisting that the King James Version itself is inspired. I receive a magazine here. I believe it comes every 2 weeks, and the chief contention of this man is that the King James Version itself was inspired of God, and that this is the Word of God. This man, of course, pays no attention to the great number of changes that have been made in the King James Version since that time, but they just insist that the King James Version is inspired, and they're calling everyone heretics, and they are calling everyone to be ungodly, that will not admit that the Stevens or the received text, the Textus Receptus, is a so-called, is the perfect and complete and inspired Greek manuscript. Well, I simply cannot go along with those at all. Among those who insist or now insisting on this, and it's hard indeed for myself and all of his friends that I've talked to understand why he's doing it, but Dr. David Otis Fuller, who for many years was pastor of the Wealthy Street Baptist Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, is one of those who is contending strongly for the inspiration of the Textus Receptus and the inspiration of the King James Version. And as I say, I've talked to some of his very close friends, and they're just at a loss to understand why that he would take this position, which, as far as I'm concerned, I believe that it is ridiculous. And yet we do have to thank God for the fact that there have been men that we call textual scholars. That these men are honest men. We believe that they are sincere men. And they will take every possible manuscript, everything that's available to them, to try to come to some conclusion as to what the original writer may have said. You see, the problem that we face, and of course this is well known, that the problem that we face is that the first would be the autograph. That would be the first copy, like John wrote the Gospel of John. Well now, let's say if we draw a line down on an angle from that, make a little arrow pointing down, we would get the first copy, you see. And then we would get a copy from the copy. But let's suppose that the first copier made a mistake. He was writing by hand, and I don't believe that anyone ever copied a long manuscript by hand without making certain mistakes. The second man copied his mistakes and made one or two of his own. The third man may have tried to straighten these out, but couldn't straighten them all out, but he made a copy. And so on. And then somebody else got the autograph, and he made a copy. And this would be more accurate than copy number two that was made from the copy, because it was made in the autograph. But then it would depend upon the carefulness and the quality of the workman. So what men do is to take these manuscripts and to work with these and to compare them. Even if it might only be a scrap, no matter what it might be, if it's only a scrap, that they can take this and that they can make the comparison and give us, if they are honest, some idea as to what the original would be. Now, for example, when Weymouth wanted to translate the New Testament, he felt that he needed a better Greek text than any was available at that time. And so he took all the manuscripts that were available to him, plus the work that was done by other editors and textual students. Bringing these all together, he came out with what was called the resultant Greek New Testament. And I have found out that in this resultant Greek New Testament that we have a most excellent text, even though it is the work of one man, but it is called resultant because it is the work of many men. And he just simply took their results and brought them all together to give us a Greek text and a text from which he could give us the Weymouth version. So we have versions galore. We have many versions, and if we would go back since 1611, well, you would be surprised. Even we'd go back before that, you know, in 1832, there was the Wycliffe Bible. That was a translation. 1525, there was the Tyndale New Testament. And in 1535, one called the Coverdale Bible. Then in 1539, the Great Bible. In 1560, there was the Geneva Bible. In 1568, the Bishop's Bible. Then in 1582, around about 1600, there was the Catholic version, the Douay Bible. It wasn't until 1611 that we got the King James Version. The King James Version. And in 1881, we got the English Revised Version. And then they began to multiply. There was one called the 20th Century New Testament in 1901, the year I was born. 1903, Richard Weymouth came up with his New Testament. And then next was in 1913, Dr. James Moffat, and so on. And we get right down to the present time where we begin to get, like in 1946, the Revised Standard Version. Beginning with 1947, the Phillips Version, those were the modern versions. And then we come along a little further, and we get the various translations here, too many to mention. Till in 1963, we got the New American Standard Bible. Years so after that, we got the Amplified Old Testament, and so on. And then we got the expanded version. Now, I have all of these versions, and they're on my shelves. But I use the King James Version. When I begin my work, I work from the King James Version, and I'll never give it up. And there are many reasons why I'll never give it up. First of all, I would say that this is the Bible of the people. It is still the bestseller. It is still the widest circulated, and it is the Bible that is most used by the people. Second reason I would not give it up is that I have shelves that are filled with concordances, lexicons, and so on, and that these are all based upon the King James Version. And they're all related to it in some way. And if I would give up the King James Version, then how in the world am I going to use my Strong's Concordance, my Young's Concordance, my Englishman's Greek Concordance, my Englishman's Hebrew Concordance, and so on, and so on, and so on? How am I going to use these books which I have found valuable to me in bringing forth the exact meaning of a single Greek word? Now, supposing that I would give up my King James Version and, let's say I would take up with the American Standard Version or this New International Version, which I bought only last night. I would find out that it would give me many better translations, many clear translations, many translations that I would accept as being more accurate and correct. And yet, if I'm going to build anything on it, if I'm going to build a doctrine and say, here I take my stand upon it, then I've got to make sure that this is what the Greek says. I've got to make sure of that. However, let me tell you something that I constantly do. I'll come upon a passage. I don't have to do this as much as I used to, but I will come upon a passage, and I would say, that's not clear to me. Doesn't seem to be right. I wonder if the fault is in the translation. And so I will almost immediately turn to, let's say the Rotherham Version. I like the Rotherham Version of the New Testament. And I'll see what Rotherham, how he translates this. And if he translates it very nearly like the King James Version, I'll say, that's okay. Then I will look at Young's literal translation. That is by Dr. Robert Young, the same man who made up Young's Concordance. And I will turn to it. And if Young says the same thing, then I will say, there's two others that are in harmony with the King James Version. But supposing then that I go on from that to the Weymouth Version. And I find that Weymouth is radically different. And I go maybe to another, and I find out that it's radically different. Now I say to myself, why the difference? And that means I must go to the Greek. Now, I do not read Greek as a language, but I do say this. I have developed the ability to take any word in the New Testament, no matter what that word is, and by the use of the tools that men have given me, to trace out the meaning of that word and the history of that word and come to some understanding of what it means. Now, I remember when I was in school, I was told that the Greek word parousia had to do with the coming of Jesus Christ for his church, and the word apokalypsen had to do with the coming of Christ with his church, and that these were 7 years apart. Well, as a young boy, I was only 20 years of age, and I said, that's good. That sounds good. I'll remember that. I'll make a note of that. These days dealing with the second coming, I'll put that out to the people. This was some grist for my sermon mill, and I'll put it out to the people. And for several years, I would do that. That the word parousia had to do with the coming of Christ for his church, and the word apokalypsen had to do with the coming of Christ 7 years later for his church. But after 2 or 3 years, I said this one night, and a very kindly, intelligent man came to me with his Bible. I did not know the man. And he said, young friend, I think it would be well if you would check out those words. I almost immediately resented what he said. I'd said this so many times, it just had to be true. I had declared it so many times, I didn't want to change on it. But he said, I think that if you will check that out, you're going to find out that you're not speaking the truth. It embarrassed me. Well, how did I check it out? You know, at that time, I hardly knew how to check it out. But one thing that I did want to find out was all the occurrences of parousia in the Bible, and all I had to do was to work through my Young's Concordance, and I found it. All the occurrences. And I had to work through Apocalypse and find all the occurrences of that word, and I found out that the Corinthians were waiting for the Apocalypse of the Lord Jesus Christ. I'd been crossed up there because it was translated coming. And Apocalypse does not mean coming, it means the unveiling. And Parousia does not mean coming, it means the personal presence. And so I thought, well, here I was taught this in school. I've said it 100 times over. I'm going to have to do my own checking. I'm going to have to check everything before I begin to build on it. And so I have taken single verses, and I have built truths on them and far-reaching doctrines. For example, I learned from others that Acts 28:28 marks a dispensational boundary line. And I accepted that, and I'm glad that I did. But then I had to go on from there, because I was going to build on that. I had to go on to there and work on the historical and the grammatical meaning of every word in it. And don't think that that was easy to do. It's very easy after someone points it out, and all you've got to do is go over it. But let me tell you, it took me years to work that out. For example, it starts out there, be it known unto you, which I came to see that Paul said, be aware of this. Not just know it, but be aware of it. You see, a man might know that a car is coming at the intersection. What he wants to do is not just know it. He's got to be aware of it and take his actions accordingly. So the Greek said, be aware of this. Then it said that the salvation of God, and you know, it took years for me to discover that that was an adjective, that this was an adjective, and that no adjective ever stands alone, which I already knew, and that all of the scholars who had worked on this said that this word meant salvation bringing, and that the noun would have to be supplied. So I made it the salvation bringing message. Right in the context, being something they will hear, that would have to be a message, a communication. And so I translated that, be aware of this, that the salvation-bringing message of God has been sent. And when I worked on the word sent and found it was the word apostello and worked for many, many months on the word apostello, I found out that when this was used of an inanimate thing, it meant that it was freely authorized, not just sent, like you would send me a letter, but that this salvation-bringing communication was freely authorized to the nations, and they will hear it. Now, that gave me a little trouble, and I was in correspondence with a man in England, and this man told me that, and he was a Greek scholar, very capable in the Greek, as New Testament Greek. And he told me that this signified, it will get through to them. You know, we say, I told him, but he wouldn't hear me. What you mean is, I told him, but I didn't get through to him. You feel if you had got through to him. And he says that that's what it means there. And so I worked on this till I got it to a place where I could straighten out. Now, that couldn't be found in any version. There is no version that gives it that way. There is no version that declares it that way. And yet I am convinced from my own labors that this is the truth. So whether I would read this in this new international version or whether I would read it in the King James Version, or whether I'd read it even in the Rotherham Version that I greatly respect, or wherever I would read it, I would never get that truth. So I might just as well start with the King James Version and to work it out for myself. I'm just turning here for a moment to this version I said that I bought last night. Let's see what it does with Acts 28:28. And this new version says, therefore, I want you to know that God's salvation has been sent to the Gentiles, and they will listen. And you see, that makes salvation to be a noun, and it makes says Gentiles instead of nations, and that's all right, but I would prefer that it would say nations. So I have to work on these things. Now you say, but I can't do that. And that's why you've got to depend upon, why you've got to check out the man who is doing it. And you have every right to check it out. You have no right at all to say, I won't even listen. You have no right to say, I won't hear. If a man has done the work, then either you check it out or get somebody honest who will check it out. Then you can decide whether this is the truth or not. So, of the making of versions, there is no end. And when it comes to some passages, you could not find a better, clearer, more exalted translation than that which is given in the King James Version. On other passages, you could not find any version that is better than, I would say, maybe the Weymouth. You could take the Greek and you just could not find it more faithfully actually translated. So, if I may be blunt, a party asked me one time, a personal friend of mine, about a certain version. Well, I said, I'll have to say of this what I would say of every version. There are places where it seems to be just perfect. After checking it all out, it seems to be just perfect. And there are other places where I'd say it's not so good. And there's other passages where I would say it simply stinks. And that's the way it is with every version. Some places, perfect. Some passages. Some passages, it just smells to high heaven. And it's up to us to work it out. You say, that's not easy to do. No, I never said that Bible study was easy. I'm just saying that there are men who will give their life to this. They'll give their life to it for the purpose of bringing out the truth. Now, most Bibles are made to sell. And if they would translate faithfully, they would never sell. The bookstores would not stock them. Not all the bookstores would stock them. And often what they want to make up is a book that will sell. And take, for example, when you come to the New Testament, and you find the Greek word Hades. And it's translated, we'll say, hell. And you find the word Gehenna, and it's translated hell. And you find the word Tartaros, and it is translated hell. And you got three words in the New Testament translated hell. Well, you say, what should you do with these words? Well, I would just transliterate Hades, and I would just carry it over. Or if I wanted to give an interpreted translation, I would just simply say the state of death. As to Gehenna, I would certainly translate that because it's a proper name. As to Tartarus, I would not translate it hell. And in fact, if I were translating the entire New Testament, the word hell would never appear. It would just simply never appear. I wouldn't use it as a translation of any word in the New Testament or any word in the Old Testament. I just wouldn't use it. And that would mean that the word hell would disappear from any version that I would make. And there are people who say, we want a Bible that's got hell in it. We want just as much hell as we can find in the Bible. And the bookstores would say, well, this would never sell. There's no hell in it. We got to have a Bible that has hell in it. Now, one reason that the American Standard Version was rejected was because that they took out all occurrences of hell and put in the word Sheol just as it is. in the Hebrew, and they used the word Sheol, which is a name of a thing. And I believe it's the name of a thing, and that thing is the state of death. The state of death to which good men went and bad men went, and their judgment would come in time, and they were there awaiting resurrection. And so I do not wholeheartedly recommend any version. I use the King James, and I'm going to stick with it. And I'm going to look at other versions, because at the best, every version is a commentary. That's all that they are. They're just commentaries. It is a man trying to tell you in his own words what the Greek said, or what the Greek says. And sometimes they do a very good job. And sometimes they do a very poor job. But some of the very best translations I have ever found is where some man worked on one verse. Just one verse. And you'll find that. You'll find that in commentaries sometime, where a man gave his thought and time to just working on one verse. So as versions multiply, I guess I'm a kind of a version-holic. Like an alcoholic, I have to almost buy every one that comes out. Oh, there's some I wouldn't even bother with. I couldn't waste my money on it, but I want them. I want to make the comparison, and I want to see what they say. Some versions are made up by committees of 100. When we see those, we think of the story about that a camel is a horse that a committee put together. Some versions were made by one man, like Weymouth. And there's a concordant version, which is the work of A. Enoch, who was a good translator, but one of the poorest interpreters that I've ever studied of the New Testament. Well, my time is up. I will have to close. I thank you for listening, and I trust that this message will be helpful.